This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again. Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you with me. From the moment Donald Trump was elected, the mainstream media pounced on the president, bashing him at every turn. And the question is, how is the supposedly unbiased news media, what role is it playing in trying to dictate to Americans who gets to be the president of this country? Well, there are few people who know that better than Adam Gillette, who's the president of the group Accuracy and Media. Adam, welcome back to the program, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me back.
If you hear a dog barking in the background, that's our new puppy, Sir Winston Churchill, and he's occasionally wanting to sound off. But I want to ask you about this because I worked as a straight-ahead news reporter for a long time, a couple of decades, and I was proud of the fact that I kept my opinion out of things, even in story choice or choice of questions, and the way I presented the final story. My job was to tell people what other people were saying and what their opinions were, not my own opinions. Now, every human being has some inbuilt biases, probably questions that we forget to ask. But I tried best I could to make my stories down the middle. Today's media seems very, very different.
Well, they're not just activists these days. You know, people, we used to complain about the media becoming biased and the media clearly having a point of view. We've long since passed that. We now see activist journalists, many of whom previously worked for Democratic candidates, worked for the Democratic Party, before going into journalism and basically continuing the same work. But now we also see supposed journalists who publish stories they know not to be true simply because they know it will sell with their audience. It's like they're writing fan fiction. They're telling their audience whatever they want to hear, even if the facts show something completely different.
Well, and I noticed tonight, Adam, one of the most recent developments from one of the newest forms of media, social media, is that Facebook has canceled out Steve Bannon. Now, I happen to like Steve Bannon. He worked for the president as a political strategist. Now he's out on his own. And they canceled him out. In this case, they say the biggest reason was the Stop the Steal movement, which was referring to the election, saying that the election was being stolen, which is an opinion. But isn't that what Facebook and Twitter are supposed to be all about, is opinion? Because even when, you know, just an average person who's using Twitter just to communicate to their friend says, I really like this restaurant, I really like this political candidate, I really like this TV show, or I hate that TV show. I mean, it's all about opinion. Very little of it is just about straightforward, unbiased presentation of the facts. And yet we get selective treatment of political figures saying, if we like a reporter whose stories turn out to be false or even demonstrably false, the kind you just referred to, we're going to allow that reporter to disseminate his stories far and wide over Twitter and Facebook. But if we don't like your story, we're going to cancel you out and your account as well.
Well, it's so much more powerful and more hypocritical than that than you might even think, because in regards to the hypocrisy, these social media sites allow the government of Iran to post horrible, hateful misinformation and propaganda. They allow the government of North Korea to use their platforms, but then they'll go and censor the president of the United States of America. Then they'll go and shadow ban conservatives and libertarians and block their posts from being visible. In hidden camera investigations, it's been proven that these Twitter folks use shadow banning tactics. They set up an algorithm so that if you're posting about certain things, you'll still be allowed to post, but your post won't be visible to very many people. So you think all is going well, but no one is interacting with your content, when in reality, nobody is seeing your content. And when asked on hidden camera who they shadow ban, how their algorithm determines who to go after, they said, well, anybody who's tweeting about God, guns, American flag emoji, that's obviously a Russian bot, is what they said. These folks are so far removed from mainstream society, they think that if you're tweeting about God or guns or the American flag emoji, you must be a Russian bot. That's how out of touch they are.
Well, and I've noticed that in the last couple of days, I don't tend to use scripture as much in my tweets as some people do, but I saw a few of them that were, you know, quoting verses from the Bible in which they were suggesting, keep your powder dry, stay calm, don't worry, we'll get through all of this, you know, to the other side, whether it's a contested election or dead people voting or whatever it happens to be. And you're telling me that people, by quoting from the Bible, are putting themselves at risk of being banned because of the bigotry, the anti-religious bigotry of the people who work inside these social media giants?
Yeah, even Pinterest has been caught going after Christians and going after pro-lifers. Pinterest was blocking people from posting pro-life articles about, I think, the organization Live Action on their website. These folks are entirely hostile to the beliefs that you and I and many other people share. They're entirely hostile to the notion of free speech. That's just not something they believe in. It's not a matter of they don't even want to hear conservatives per se. They just don't believe in hate or in free speech. They don't believe in public discourse. They believe in censoring. They believe in book burning. They believe in shouting out the opposition and using violent methods to achieve their goals. It's a terrifying, totalitarian, dark world that they want to live in.
I'm talking to Adam Gillette, who's president of the group Accuracy and Media. Well, Adam, can a representative form of government survive this kind of thing? Because you and I both know these social media giants, while anybody can jump in, there's Parler to try to counter Twitter. But Twitter is gigantic. And once you get that critical mass, is there any way to stop you from acting as though you're going to turn the American news media into something like TASS, or the official China news agent? TASS is the old Soviet one, but the China news agency, where you understand this is the voice of the elite and it will silence all the other voices. That seems like something that's actually corrosive to our form of government.
Well, that's a really great question. And in many ways, it's similar to the challenge we faced when our organization was formed 51 years ago. We were actually created in response to Walter Cronkite's coverage of the Vietnam War.
Oh, God.
He would say things like, the war is now unwinnable after the Tet Offensive, which was actually a massive defeat for the North. And at the time, everyone said, well, what are you going to do? ABC, CBS, NBC, The New York Times, they're so powerful. We're never going to be able to do anything else. We're never going to have an accurate viewpoint anywhere. But when we expose them again and again and again and expose their bias, eventually the public caught on to it. When the founder of our organization passed away, The New York Times actually credited us with, or blamed us, with causing less trust within the media. And you know what happened? Once there became an overwhelming demand for alternative media sources, that's when you got talk radio. That's when you got Fox News. That's when you had the explosion of the internet. We need the same thing here. We need to get people educated and to get them to understand how biased, how much they dislike your viewpoints, how much they want you blocked and banned from civil discourse. Even if they wish to achieve the goals that they've got where they advance their beliefs, they're going about it entirely the wrong way. As you said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. The way to get rid of bad, horrible, dangerous ideas in our society isn't to shout people down. It's to have more opportunities to express good ideas. There used to be a society. It used to be civil discourse in America where we could agree to disagree. Now the progressive left has gotten rid of that entirely. If they don't believe in agreeing to disagree. I miss actual liberals. I miss a left-wing full of Bill Maher types who, even if we disagree with them, they're open-minded. They'll happily have a discussion with you. They want to hear opposing viewpoints. Today's totalitarian progressive left has no interest in open disagreement, interest in candid discussion.
And you know what's going to happen, Adam? The Bill Maher's of the world are probably going to face cancel culture, and perhaps even yours truly as well. That's Adam Gillette, president of Accuracy and Media. Back in just a moment to your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails a bit later on at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You know, I talk about charter schools all the time on this program, but I have to tell you, when I get the opportunity to talk to one of America's leading economists, he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. I missed my trip to Hoover this year because of the China virus, but I do get a chance to talk to Dr. Thomas Sowell, who has been at Hoover. He is a senior fellow there, and he's written a book specifically about charter schools with what I consider, the book is just out now, but I think it's a bold title, Charter Schools and Their Enemies, short, sweet, and to the point. Dr. Sowell, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program.
It's good to be back.
Now, I have to admit, I always tell my audience if I have a dog in the fight, I'm a fan of charter schools, never having attended them, never having sent my children went to public schools, but they didn't go to charter schools, and I wish they had been more available when my kids were kids. They're adults now, but you stated very plainly, charter schools are a good reform of America's public school education, but they have enemies. Tell me about that, please, and what you say in the new book.
Well, first, it's the question of the performance. It's hard to get a good comparison between charter schools and traditional public schools for a couple of reasons. One is that in traditional public schools nationwide, white students plus Asian students are a majority of students. For charter schools, black students plus Hispanic students are a majority of the students. And so you're comparing two different populations, not just two different schools or two different kinds of schools. And early on in the book, I show how that matters. If you just look at comparisons of test scores in the 50 states, Iowa has higher test scores than Texas. But if you break it down by race, you find out that whites in Texas score higher than whites in Iowa. Blacks in Texas score higher than blacks in Iowa. Asians in Texas score higher than Asians in Iowa. And Hispanics in Texas score higher than Hispanics in Iowa. And so the question is, how in the world did Iowa manage to have better test scores? And the answer is that the population of Iowa is overwhelmingly white, and the population of Texas has a much larger share of low-income minorities. So if you go by gross statistics, you would say Iowa has the better schools. But if you break it down, you say, no, Texas has the better schools. And the same thing here. So the first thing I try to do is get comparisons between comparable sets of students. And for that, I go to New York, where there are more than 23,000 students in schools where the charter school and the traditional public schools for the same neighborhood are holding classes in the same building. And therefore, you get very comparable students in the two places. And then you can make your comparisons. And when you do that, you find that, let's say in mathematics, 10% of the traditional public schools of that sort, which is to say traditional public schools in predominantly minority communities, only 10% of the students meet the statewide standards for proficiency at their grade level.
Wow.
In the charter schools, in the very same buildings, in the very same class levels, 68% meet the standards. And so this is almost a 7-to-1 difference. And that's what you don't see in most of the comparisons that are published.
I'm talking to Dr. Thomas Sowell from the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Doctor, you just busted one of the most common stereotypes that I hear from people as a criticism of charter schools. They say, oh yeah, you want charter schools, those will take care of the elite, meaning, and some of that translates as elite, mostly white population of school students in America. But you just pointed out it charter schools, and I know that some of them were started early on by the parents of children with handicaps so that they could better serve their kids because they knew that amount of money would provide better education if only they applied it the right way. But you've pointed out that in America, a majority, if you count Hispanic and black students in charter schools, they are a majority of charter schools populations because those charter schools have been chosen by black parents to say, this school will serve my children better.
Yeah, and as far as income, one of the things I have in the book is comparison of what percentage of the students are declared economically disadvantaged by the official definition, and it's a majority in both those kinds of schools. So these are not the what W.E.B. Du Bois used to call the talented tenth, you know, the children of doctors and lawyers and so forth. These are kids who's in the most successful of these charter schools. The average family income is just under $50,000. And that's in the Success Academy charter school chain, and yet a higher percentage of them pass the statewide tests in mathematics than in any school district in the state of New York, and that includes school districts where the average family income ranges up to more than $250,000 a year.
I'm talking to Dr. Thomas Sowell. The brand new book that's out from Dr. Sowell, who's just an absolutely excellent economist. I use the term apples to apples. I don't think professional economists do that, although you know what they mean. His brand new book is called Charter Schools and Their Enemies. Before we get to the enemies part of this, Dr. Sowell, would you mind helping me bust another stereotype? Because I want to tell my audience about this. they say sometimes they will email or they'll call my show and they'll say, hey, but charter schools fail. And I say, no, failure is a good thing, because in the private sector, somebody comes up with a business idea and it's not quite right, it fails. If they come up with a successful business idea, it succeeds. So is it a good thing that occasionally we see charter schools fail, whereas government schools never seem to fail?
Oh, absolutely. My gosh. You couldn't even define failure if the public school people had their way. They don't want test scores released publicly. They intimidate people into not letting the test scores out. Unfortunately for them, the New York State Education Department puts these test scores online.
And because they put them online, we can see that by the numbers, when you gave me that number about New York public schools, that I believe it was in math, they're only showing 10% of the students as meeting the minimum or adequate benchmarks of the state of New York.
That's for the ones that are housed in the same buildings, which means that they're in minority communities.
So that's the cohort that they're in. So you're saying here's a neighborhood where if you let the kids go to a poor kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, and white kids, if they go to the public school, probably 10% of them will meet the minimum benchmarks in math. The rest will fail. And that's the benchmark you work against. And charter schools produce what kind of result?
68%.
I'm talking to Dr. Thomas Sowell. He's got a brand new book out called Charter Schools and Their Enemies. In a moment, we're going to come back. I want to talk to Dr. Sowell about the enemies. Now, I've got my own ideas, and you've heard them on this program before, about the unions, about other forces that conspire to say, we don't want to give parents or students any choice in schools, because if we gave them that choice, they would probably choose to put their kids, as the New York parents might do it, to say, I want my kid to be one of the successes. I want my child to go to a charter school instead of failing or having a 90% chance of failing, in math in particular, in public schools. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails, and we'll talk about other things later. But I have the great pleasure, the distinct pleasure, of talking to Dr. Thomas Sowell, one of the leading economists in the United States of America. Of course, you know we've talked to him before when we've done our broadcast down at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. I hope to get back to that next year. Dr. Sowell has joined me because he has a brand new book out called Charter Schools and Their Enemies. So we've talked about the fact that charter schools are not predominantly populated by elite white students or the students of elite white families. They are predominantly populated by black and Hispanic students who do much better in charter schools than they do in traditional government schools. And the white students do better there as well. Let's talk about the enemies you mentioned in the book. Make the case for me, because there will be people in my audience who are not convinced that there are forces out there fighting to keep charter schools out of the picture.
Well, and the first question I had when I first learned this is what reason could they have, and I very quickly found out. Last year in New York City, for example, more than 50,000 students were on a waiting list to get into some charter school. Now, in New York City, it so happens that the expenditure per pupil is well over $20,000.
Wow.
You do the math, if 50,000 students leave the traditional public schools and go into the charter schools, then that means not only a transfer of those 50,000 students, it means a transfer of more than $1 billion a year.
Wow.
From the traditional public schools into the charter schools. That's a lot of reasons for the people who run the traditional public schools to do everything they can to prevent those students from transferring.
Hey, doctor, since you're an economist and I just barely finished high school math, would you mind helping me with something? Because one of my favorite comparisons is this. When you say average spending per student, you know, all funds counted in, $20,000 per student, usually we look at those big numbers like 50,000 kids waiting to get into charter schools and how much money the whole system would lose, $1 billion in the New York public schools. Take it down to the classroom level. Let's say you have a relatively uncrowded classroom of 25 students. My high school math tells me there's $500,000 in public resources going into that classroom. Now, I know that New York public school teachers are reasonably well compensated for a three-quarter time job, because it is a three-quarter time job. they make over $100,000 a year. And if you count salary and benefits and all, it's quite a number. But it's not $500,000. How could we be spending $500,000 a classroom? $100 or $125 goes to the teacher. I know they spend on light bulbs and floor wax. But other than that, how in the world do you spend the other $375,000 per classroom times thousands of classrooms? Where does it go?
Never fear that money will sit around and gather dust. If there is money coming in, it will be. People will find their way to get it. You increase the number of teachers, aides, all kinds of school nurses. There's endless ways of wasting that money, in fact, both Democrats and Republicans who looked into this have said, you know, we appropriate another $1 billion, and we have nothing to show for it. The test scores don't go up. The kids don't do any better in any other way. And most of that money is intercepted before it ever comes near a classroom.
And things like administrative costs, overhead, that sort of thing?
And union rules that maximize the amount of income of the people. When Eva Moskowitz, who founded the Success Academy Charter Schools, moved into a building in one of the public school buildings, there were complaints from the people who changed light bulbs because she had discovered that every time she looks around, there are people out there changing light bulbs. And she found out that these are light bulbs with very short lives. So she immediately ordered light bulbs with very long lives. And she got complaints because these people were earning overtime changing these bulbs, and now she's, you know, hit them in the pocketbook.
What in the world are they going to do with LEDs? I just put up an LED out in my shop, and it has an expected lifetime of 45 years. That's going to wipe out a lot of union jobs, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And a painter similarly, they have all kinds of rules. You know, you get some kind of stain or other on the classroom wall. Well, you're allowed to, and immediately if you want to paint over that, but you can't paint above a certain level on the wall without calling in the union painter.
What? I mean, I wish my wife had discovered that because she has me painting pretty high on the wall. And at 61, I don't like getting up on ladders, and I don't imagine you do either. Doctor, I'm talking to Dr. Thomas Sowell. He's written a brand new, it's just out. It's called Charter Schools and Their Enemies. Let's go back to the enemies, though. I've told my audience I think unions are one of the things that fights against charter schools. So are school administrators who see students. You may not think I'm being charitable enough to administrators, but I think they see them as chattel and as cattle. And that when they see some of their cattle about to leave the barn, they say, no, those cattle have to stay in my barn. I can't let them go to the other barn, the charter school barn, because they're viewing your kids as just a dollar sign. So how do we fight against that and persuade the teachers and the parents, and the students, you'll all be better off if we allow charter schools to prosper and the public schools have to feel some competition?
You're not going to convince the teachers because they're going to lose their jobs. And that doesn't mean they can transfer into the charter schools, because the charter schools judge teachers by how well they teach students. They don't judge them by how many teachers' college credentials they have.
But there is a way to fight that because, well, I understand what you're saying, but the charter schools will need perhaps roughly the same number of teachers, but as you say, they pay based on merit rather than based on credentials. So if we could persuade the professional side, there are a lot of professional teachers out there who are very good at what they do, but there's a lot of chaff out there along with the wheat. So how do we separate out the wheat from the chaff and say, if you really want to be rewarded well, how about teaching in a system in which a good charter school in an ideal world would be able to say, we're going to hire the finest math teacher in Minneapolis or the finest one in Miami, and we're going to pay them top dollar. On the other hand, the shop teacher might not make as much as the teacher who teaches calculus really well because the marketplace might view their skills differently. Or it might even be the reverse. The shop teacher would say, I can make so much more in the private sector. You want me to teach high school kids how to cut boards and measure? You're going to have to pay me very well. But the marketplace would decide.
Well, unfortunately, it was just yesterday I had a discussion with someone on this very point. the teachers do not want merit pay, and I think they're quite they're protecting their own self-interest, because many, if not most of them, would not be accepted in charter schools or in private. And in both private schools and charter schools, the teachers' college credentials do not have nearly as much effect as they have in the traditional public schools. And so you get a lot of people in, who can make it as teachers in the traditional public schools and not be fired. I mean, to fire a public school teacher will take you more than 2 years of procedures. And all the classes she teaches in the meantime will all suffer from her being there. So from a standpoint of the kinds of people who are attracted into the traditional public schools as they exist, there's not much question in my mind, at least, that they would be worse off if they were judged by the quality of their work, because they have many more people who don't have all the teachers' college credentials who are doing a better job that they'd have to now compete against. The very idea of competition is anathema to people in the traditional public schools.
I'm talking to Dr. Thomas Sowell. You recognize his name because he's one of the top economists in the United States of America. His latest book is called Charter Schools and Their Enemies. Doctor, can I persuade you to stay for a few more minutes for another segment?
Oh, absolutely.
I'd very much enjoy it. The book is called Charter Schools and Their Enemies. Its author is Dr. Thomas Sowell. You know him from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and a real pleasure to have Dr. Thomas Sowell with me. You've heard him before, and you've read him before, and you've heard him on many other shows and on this show before. Doctor, I want to take this in a different direction. A few years ago, I was at Hoover doing a broadcast, and I mentioned to some of the people working there, including some people who are now working in the federal government, I said, I was talking to Dr. Sowell about his stunted career in baseball. And they said, he was in baseball? I said, yeah, you didn't know that? And they said, we've been working with him for years. We didn't know that. Now, I mentioned that to you at the beginning before we began this interview. And I asked you about it, and you said, and you failed. In line with or in aid of talking about charter schools and education, would you mind telling my audience about Dr. Thomas Sowell, top economist, author of so many books, Stanford University and the Hoover Institution, and your background in professional baseball?
Well, Brad, that's very easy to do because I had no background in professional baseball. I had a tryout with the Brooklyn Dodgers, circumstances were my normal position was center field, but it takes me a long time to get up to midseason form in center field. And the tryout was held in the spring, and I knew I'd better try out at first base. And it turns out I wasn't that good a first baseman. And moreover, the Dodgers at that time would only let you come to bat after you'd passed the fielding test. So as I come in, then I see this ballpark, and I could just see myself hitting home runs over that right field fence and so on. And, of course, I never got to come to bat because I was not that good at first base.
Now, tell me this, though. You were judged based on your merit. You were a good baseball player at that point to even be able to get to the tryouts, but you weren't quite good enough, right?
Right.
But is there anything wrong? Do you think Americans see anything inherently wrong with judging people based on the merit of their performance?
No, not Americans in general. But there are other Americans who are determined that's not the way to do it. And so they talk about things like inclusion and diversity and so forth, all of which means to me make-believe equality. The successful charter schools give the black and Hispanic students, among others. And incidentally, I don't know of any of the Success Academy schools that I, in my study, where there were as many as 5% white students. So the white students were just an absolute negligible part of this thing. But in any case, the charter schools give these minority youngsters real equality of skills. The more successful ones, I think of the Success Academy Network, for example, a higher percentage of those kids in that network of charter schools pass the statewide tests than the school in any public school district in the entire state of New York. And so that includes states, places where the average family income is more than $250,000 a year. So it's a huge success, and that's real success at real skills. Putting kids in institutions that are over their head for whatever reason, it has a track record of not helping them and of increasing the number of kids who don't make it at all.
Dr. Thomas Sowell is with me. His brand new book is called Charter Schools and Their Enemies. So let me ask you about something. You mentioned diversity and inclusion, two words that I've heard literally thousands of times in the last few years as people say this should be our goal. You point out that when you tell a student your work is very good, when it isn't very good, aren't you setting that student up for really bad times ahead?
Absolutely. When I was teaching at Cornell many years ago, they decided that they're going to increase the number of black students there by lowering the entry standards. And soon after that, I learned that half the black kids at Cornell were on academic probation because they weren't doing well in the courses. And so I go over to the administration building and start looking at the SAT scores of these kids. It turns out that the average black kid at Cornell at that time scored at the 75th percentile. In other words, those kids did better than three-quarters of all American college students. Why then were they failing? They were failing because they were at Cornell University, where the liberal arts students were at the 99th percentile. And I, like the rest of the faculty, tended to teach at the level of the students that we had, which was the 99th percentile. And so we were going too fast for the others who had at the 75th percentile. If they were in an average or even above average American college, they would be doing fine. They would be succeeding. They ended up, many of them, punching out and going away failures.
You know, Dr. Sowell, one of my favorite actors is Clint Eastwood, and one of his famous lines from decades ago is, a man should know his limitations. Now, listen, I also believe that a man's reach should exceed his grasp or what's heaven for, but I know the things I'm reasonably good at, and I know the things I'm not very good at. And so it must be demoralizing as a student to be told, you get to go to Cornell, you get to wear the sweatshirt, you can brag, your parents can brag, why my son or daughter is at Cornell. But then if you're sitting there in the classroom and you feel as though you're in that 75th percentile and you're trying to keep up with the kids in the 99th and the professor who's teaching to the level of the 99th, it must be a psychological blow that might be tough to overcome, even if you're the hardest working student in the world.
No question about it. You can't. These little remedial courses they have in college are a bad joke.
I so thank you for the time, Doctor.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
It is my pleasure. Take care now. That's Dr. Thomas Sowell, and this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you, and always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. This subject that I want to talk to our law enforcement go-to guy, Bernie Giusto, about. As you know, he used to be a sheriff, and he was a police chief as well, and did both of those with honor, and has now retired from both those jobs. We go to him with questions like this. One of the ongoing themes of the last 6 or 8 months during the Antifa and BLM riots all over America has been that the police shoot people for no good reason. Of course, when you start taking a look at the particular cases, you find cases where, well, yeah, they shot him because he was pointing a gun at them and he'd already shot a couple of people. Situations like that. And a reasonable person says, well, if you have somebody who's already shot people, sent them to the hospital, and is now pointing a gun at the cops, what choice do they have? So, Bernie, and does using deadly force mean the police should shoot till the suspect is dead?
You know, Lars, where you start is where I started law enforcement in 1974, the Oregon State Police. And back then, like many things that have changed, like pursuit policies and that kind of thing, you know, bad situations, we just anticipate they're going to end badly when they start badly, meaning that the cops under all conditions, when they have to make decisions based on what the evidence in front of them or the situation in front of them, continue on with that from start to finish. And that worked for a long time, and we got support from people that we work for. Still gets a lot of support in the community. But unfortunately, the discussion about qualified immunity, meaning when police officers have immunity simply because of the fact that the job they have and the decisions they have to make are starting to get more fine-tuned, a lot more fine-tuned in the courts. And what the courts are saying across the country is, you know, if a little bit's good, a lot may be not better, or in fact, it may be subject you to losing that qualified immunity. And a case that probably points it out as well as I've seen is a case out of Los Bonas, California, where a person, and this is to the issue again, Lars, is who shows up when there's a mental health call and what the situation can turn into. So a person, a father who lived with a son who had mental illness problems, called the police with two hopes. Number one, the police officer would make him behave, and then two, get him to mental health help. When the police officer confronted the individual, let me use another word, when the police officer went face-to-face with the individual in that individual's room, he was stabbed in the arm. The officer, with a pair of scissors, the officer drew, fired a round, but then the gun jammed. And between the time that the officer fired, hit the subject in the leg, and retreated down the hall, his gun jammed, and he went to tap, rack, and roll. That's just a way of saying clear the weapon and see if you can get it to fire correctly the next time around. The person had dropped the scissors, but the officer fired again, at killing the suspect. So in the old days, there wouldn't have been much case about that. The officer got stabbed, he shot, he retreated, he shot again. And typically, when we were trained on the range, it was holster a safe weapon. That was the command given by the range master, meaning that you've decided to quit shooting. We've given you instruction how to shoot, when to shoot. Now it's time to close that up, to holster that safe weapon.
Right.
Not anymore. The court's saying that second shot should have never occurred. The threat was ended, and the officer needed to breathe, reassess, retreat, reassess, and make a different decision. And so he wasn't entitled to qualified immunity.
Well, but let me ask you something about this, because that particular case, when the crazy guy stabs the officer in the arm with scissors and the officer retreats down a hallway, when the crazy guy pursues him anyway, his name is Sonny Lamb, he's a 42-year-old man with mental illness, when he pursues him into the hallway, he didn't have to do that. And for all the officer knows, he had a pair of scissors that he stabbed the officer with. He might have picked up a pistol on his way, but then I guess you'd say, well, then wait till the officer can actually say, I saw the pistol in his hands. But I guess what frustrates me is hearing the cases like this one, where we're just telling police officers, you are expected to do everything perfectly. You're dealing with an imperfect world, or a man with mental illness who refuses to take his medication. His dad calls for help. And now we have people saying, well, instead of sending an armed cop, why don't we send a social worker? How do you think the social worker might have fared in that same situation, telling the young man, you've got to take your meds, and the young man stabs the social worker, and the social worker has no ability to respond to that at all, except maybe retreat, hopefully successfully?
Yeah, and unknown about the mental illness question, as law enforcement finds itself often, is in fact the uniform the reason that the situation goes bad? Is that why, or from bad to worse, because the person becomes resistant to the uniform, not the conversation? And that's yet to be seen. But in the situation that we're talking about, although I agree with you, Lars, and I'm an old-time cop, you know, and I would have said that second shot should have been okay, but, you know, because in the heat of battle, how are you going to know? Well, that's not the way the Ninth Circuit saw it. He was entitled to the first shot, but he was not entitled to the second shot.
Well, and Bernie, to some extent, I kind of agree with that, because every time somebody calls this show and says, well, what about shooting somebody? I said, if you believe your life is in danger right now, you can take what actions are necessary to protect yourself. And the minute that threat is gone, you don't get to shoot anymore. That applies to civilians. It also applies to cops. And it sounds like the Ninth Circuit Court, which I don't have a lot of respect for most of the time, although they've gotten better with some new appointments, if they looked at it and said, well, was the threat still there when the officer is down the hallway and the guy is, although you and I have talked too recently about the fact that if this crazy guy still has his scissors in his hands and he's less than 20 feet, 21 feet from the officer, he can kill the officer before the officer can kill him. So maybe the officer's life was still in danger at that point and the second shot was justified. But in general, what should we do when people are demanding that the police do their job without control holds, without, you know, neck holds, without and tasers kill people too occasionally, and don't use a gun. I mean, in other words, you're being stripped of all the tools that you used to do your job with, and at this point, it's only your persuasive abilities, I guess, that are still going to be allowed to be used.
Well, I got to tell you, it falls back again, Lars. We've had this conversation before on police administrations that see this coming in the courts. It wasn't. It was a discussion in the population until it gets to the courts. Now you're putting individual officers' careers and actually freedoms at risk to be charged criminally. So it's while I agree with kind of the issue of what are we supposed to do? That's not going to work any longer. So we're going to have to start teaching things like we have to teach a whole different mindset with officers about force of any kind. The 4th and 11th Circuit Courts ruled on use of tasers by corrections deputies in jails, where basically all this shortcut the cases. Both people were very resistant to doing what they were being asked to do, and both courts said, yes, the first tase was okay, but because the first guy didn't, or the second guy didn't respond within the 5 seconds you decided he should respond and been hit with 50,000 volts at 1 amp, fact of the matter is that that we don't care. That's not the issue. You are not going to hit him two more times with that taser, having nothing to do with either one of them dying. That wasn't what happened in these cases. They're just saying that the use of force now has to be more discernible, and law enforcement agencies that refuse to see it.
Unfortunately, that's true. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We've got now two vaccines developed for the China virus, and things are actually looking pretty good. Thought I'd join you and allow you to join me, I should say. If you want to jump into the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Been about 400 years since the Mayflower arrived at Plymouth Rock, but are we still upholding the principles that the pilgrims came here to build our country upon? I thought we'd talk about that with Joseph LaConte, who is director of the B. Kenneth Simon Center for American Studies and with the Family Foundation Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Mr. LaConte, welcome to the program.
Well, Lars, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me. And just so you know, it's Italian. It's LaConte, Italian-American. You turned me into a Frenchman there.
Oh, well, see, I got the the emphasis on the wrong syllable. So, sorry about that. I didn't mean to do that.
No, that's fine. LaConte is fine. You're doing this
LaConte.
Fine.
Well, I have Italian friends, so I don't want to mess them up either.
Tell me this.
There are times when people have beliefs about what certain folks hundreds of years ago stood for. Do we understand the principles that the pilgrims believed in? And is that really the bedrock of our country? And are we still practicing that today?
Fabulous questions, Lars. I think the answer to the first question is sadly no. I would say most Americans don't understand what the pilgrims accomplished, the principles they laid down. They're not familiar, really, even with our constitutional system of government anymore. This is true. It's true across so many sectors of society. And I think it's really important that you're taking some time in your program to help your listeners to kind of reflect on the amazing achievement of these pilgrims in 1620, the Mayflower Compact. It's an astonishing document.
It is, but in simple terms, you know, you could talk to most grade school kids and they'd say, well, the pilgrims were I guess we'd call it religious persecution. They were the subjects of religious persecution. And they said, fine, we'll leave and we'll go somewhere else and we'll create a community that is free from religious persecution. Now, there are certainly examples of religious persecution in the United States, even after the United States was formed. But we've worked with an aspirational goal of getting rid of that, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly right. And I think there's a debt there to the pilgrims, which the founding fathers took note of. What's the debt? It's a very short document, the Mayflower Compact. When they composed it and signed it, they did under real pressure because their own community of about 102 people, they weren't all separatists trying to flee the Church of England. More than half of them weren't as religiously motivated. They were more commercially motivated. So they had real fractures potentially in the community. So what do? They come together and agree, we're going to submit ourselves to laws that we ourselves write. We call that self-government. Yes, they were still honoring the king. They were still under his authority. But here, where they were going to land eventually there in Plymouth, the laws we write are going to govern this community. And what they described them was just and equal laws apply to everybody. In other words, the principle of equal justice under the law. That's not bad.
Joseph Leconte. Joseph Leconte, the Italian, makes the point. So they imagined way before John Adams ever talked about a nation of laws, not a nation of men, that they would write a set of rules, it would apply to everybody, and it wasn't just whether or not you were buddies with the governor or the mayor or whatever.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. Now, we want to be clear about some of this. Not everyone was invited to sign that document. The women were excluded, which is unfortunate because they would do so much to keep the colony alive in the following bitter winter months. But most of the men are able to sign it, no matter what their station of life is. So when the founders are looking for examples of self-government, they look right there at the earliest beginnings of the country in 1620. And that's really important now because we're having, of course, a debate launched by the New York Times and their 1619 project a year ago, to discredit the American founding, to discredit the roots of the American political order. And they want to make the founding 1619 when slaves were first brought to these shores, enslaved Africans. Well, it's just so far from the truth in terms of understanding the remarkable democratic achievements of this country.
And in simple terms, Mr. Leconte, couldn't we indict every single civilization that's ever existed on Earth? Because there's been slavery among human beings on every continent, in virtually every single country on the planet. And in fact, slavery is still practiced in some areas today. And in fact, I would even argue that sex trafficking of either children or adults is a modern equivalent of that, which to some extent, sadly, society doesn't do enough about. But if that was the founding, then you're indicting every society, saying every human society is flawed then, isn't it, by that logic?
That's precisely right. This is where Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's the author of this, really, this tirade, this diatribe that she's contrived at the New York Times, you'd never know that slavery was a universal human problem. Every civilization on the planet. I actually function as an historian. That's my credit card, if you will. That's my calling card. I'm one of those professional historians who got minted as an historian. So I do know something about the history of the West and the history of other civilizations. And you're absolutely right. It's this universal human problem. And the amazing thing, not only about Plymouth and the Pilgrims, but then, of course, the American revolutionaries who follow in their steps, is they declare that human slavery now is going to be put on notice. That's the great culmination of the Declaration of Independence, isn't it? Human slavery, the idea of enslaving and subjugating other human beings, that concept is now put on notice with the American Revolution.
I guess where I get frustrated with people, say, but it wasn't that, you know, they hadn't achieved that yet. And I said, no, it was an aspirational document. It's like talking to an 18-year-old high school student and saying, what are you going to do? And he or she says, I'm going to be a doctor. Yeah. And if I turned around and said, but you're not one right now, are you? His parents and all my friends would think, well, what a boorish thing to say. He aspires to be a doctor, and it'll take some work, and he'll probably get there eventually. America is the same, isn't it?
That's exactly right, Lars. I mean, I think what we have here, particularly on the progressive left, we have a collection of a very emotionally immature, embittered utopians. They want the world to exist and function in a certain way, according to the utopian dreams, and it doesn't. It never does anywhere. And the amazing thing about the American story is the way in which we are always striving for a more perfect union, a more just society, a more humane and just society. But all that's swept aside by the left. That's why it's important to pause and remember what those brave men and women did crossing the Atlantic in this miserable trip across the Atlantic, seeking some measure of religious freedom for themselves. Maybe not for everybody else, but certainly for themselves, the idea of the importance of freedom of conscience before God. It wasn't a theocratic mission these guys were on, but it was a sort of human liberty mission. And that's worth stopping and thinking about here on these shores.
Mr. Leconte, one of the things about that is that it would have been very easy to imagine a group of people saying, since we've been oppressed and our religion was not allowed, we want to go somewhere and set it up so that only our religion is allowed, no competitors. You could imagine people doing that very easily, but they didn't. They thought broader than that.
Yeah, I think that's true. America has had its examples of a more hard-line militant religion. It's not like we've been completely free of that, because it's a human problem. But what the Pilgrims did was, because they were a mixed bag, as I say, about 40 of the 102 or so of these Pilgrims were really Pilgrims, were really kind of the saints, they call themselves.
Very good. Mr. Licati, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much, and thanks for being the historian that you have been.
Thanks so much for the call. Great to be with you, sir. Thank you.
It is a pleasure to have you on. Joseph Licati, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I'll remind you that going all the way back to February and March of this year, when people said, well, who's going to solve this problem of the COVID-19 or China virus, whatever you want to call it? And I said, the solution is not going to come from the folks in government. They are, in fact, the worst place to look for solutions to just about anything, because they could, I think they could screw up an ice cream sundae, is my personal point of view. Now, I don't know if Jim Bourneau agrees with me on that, but he's in an entirely different business than I am. He's the CEO and founder of Willamette Valley Vineyards. But his business has figured out a way to deal with concerns about employee safety and customer safety. And you issued a statement today, Jim, and I wanted to get you to tell my audience about it. Thanks very much for coming on the program, by the way.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate being able to talk about, really, I used to say, Lars, that at the early on, I said, hey, let's give our government officials some grace. This is their first pandemic. But as you pointed out in your lead, we've had a lot of time to learn about this COVID virus and how to protect our employees and our guests. And what's amazing to me and disappointing is how wrong-headed the policy is the governor just announced.
Well, and in fact, I pointed out, Jim, just I want to remind my audience, there's a company called White Star that makes trucks. And early on, they were considered essential, so they were allowed to stay open anyway. But they did some amazing things in the first couple of months to change their entire process so that their employees stayed safe but could still make trucks. And some of it was, you know, simple garden variety stuff like splitting their 600 workforce into two shifts so they had more room, and then taking some ordinary steps to keep everybody a lot safer. And I said, I featured them on the show saying that's the way to do it. Would you mind describing what Willamette Valley Vineyard and how your entire investment in this solution for both employees and customers is now put aside because the governor's order says you can't use it anyway?
That's right. Well, first of all, we did just exactly as you described. In our production facilities, we did the very same thing, changing how we did what we did to make sure that each employee was protected. But to protect our guests and employees, we installed a new technology in our HVAC systems. It cost us a lot of money, and it uses UVC light to kill the coronavirus in the air, in the HVAC systems. We also put them in all of our employees' offices. In addition, we covered everything with what's called a micro shield, which is all of our chairs, bar tops, floors, all of the fixtures in the bathrooms and even the door handles will kill a virus when it lands on those surfaces. We also changed the practices in which we receive our guests. We went to all reservation only in very small groups. And then just recently, we purchased igloos. We have igloos we put outside, which allows the family to maintain its bubble. A family could actually maintain in their safety bubble, could come and enjoy food and wine in these outdoor igloos. And then they're ventilated and cleaned for each use. So we've spent over $50,000 at Willamette Valley Vineyards to protect our employees and our guests. And we've not had one case among our employees have contacted the coronavirus through their workplace, nor any contact traced guest. And you know that we get a lot of visitors.
Yeah, you do. But what's going to happen now that the governor has put out this shutdown order? All that money you've spent now can't be put to use, even though you should be able to stay open. That's what I hear you saying. Am I right?
That's right. That's correct. This is the wrong, absolutely the wrong policy. And here's the danger that these policies have. The government really needs the compliance and support and confidence of the public in order to be effective. But when they do things that are clearly wrong, they lose the public's confidence and they lose the public's cooperation. That's really the greatest danger in bad government policy. because it's going to require
Jim,
all of us. Go
I'm
ahead,
sorry. Jim, I, no, but I, you're speaking my language, because this is what I've been telling people all the way back to February, is that, you know, the government usually sees a one-size-fits-all because they see everything within political boundaries. So even within a certain county in Washington or Oregon, they'll say if the county has Spokane in, then the same rules apply inside the city of Spokane as they do, you know, 20 miles away in part of Spokane County, because they see everything within a boundary. So everything within this circle has to have the same solution. Whereas the private sector, you say, okay, there may be other wineries that do things differently. They don't have what we have. We have things they don't have. They have things we don't have. But we each come up with our own unique solution to that problem. And I don't see any way that the government can come up with a solution for entire counties or an entire state that fits everybody well. It's going to overregulate some. It's going to underregulate others. And in the case of a business like yours, if somebody goes to the boss and says, boss, you know, for a few thousand dollars or for $10,000 or $20,000, we could make ourselves safe. And the boss says, yeah, I'd do that, except I'm going to go spend the money. And then Kate Brown is going to tell me I can't operate anyway. So what's
That's it takes the incentive away from the business owner to find solutions and to spend money finding solutions for the public and their employees. It defeats that very that very level of cooperation and innovation that can occur in the private sector. So that's what this is, really a really bad policy. It's not thought through. Our industry is very, very unhappy about what has happened. And as just you pointed out, look how ludicrous this is. I mean, when you have these state lines out in wine country, I mean, you don't know where the county line. You don't know where that county line starts or stops, and you could drive out from you know, Multnomah County or Washington County. You could drive out into Yamhill County, but that doesn't really address the spreading of the virus. So this county by county approach is wrongheaded, and the approach that they're using on small business is devastating. There's going to be small business wineries that are going to be crushed by this kind of decision making. And these are wineries that have spent good money to protect the public.
Like yours, with the micro shields, with the igloos. I saw early on there were restaurants in foreign countries, in places like Spain and other places, said we're going to buy those little greenhouses that you can buy at Harbor Freight, or we have little inflatable bubbles. I mean, they were trying everything. But it's the kind of innovation I never see from the government. The government is, I mean, and I know people say you just hate government. I don't hate government, but I understand that it's a tool. I also understand the flaws in the tool. I have a chainsaw. I use it on some things. I don't use it on others. It is not a good tool for all things. In fact, there are very few tools that work on all things. But I do know that when the government comes in and says, how can we write a rule that will apply to an entire county? They just do it and damn the consequences. And I wish what they do is say, we want you to find a safe way to operate. And if you think you've done that, go ahead and operate. And if we come in and we say, well, you could do this a little differently, okay, fine. Solutions, suggestions, they're all great. But they're literally going, and I just mentioned to Dr. Wattenberg, that they're going into businesses in Central Oregon and other places and saying, you aren't making your customers comply. They don't have the capability to make their customers do something. Just like I don't think the government has the ability to say, you must do this, or what? You're going to throw me in jail? That's crazy.
Right. You're exactly right, Lars. Like I said, in order to stop this virus, you have to have the support and have the confidence by the public. And these wrong-headed, poorly thought out decisions that are very arbitrary by our government leaders are not serving that purpose. They're eroding their confidence. It's a terrible mistake. And here we are, just like you said, there's many small businesses that have invested thousands in protecting their guests and their employees. And now they're being told that you don't even get to make any income. The other part of this, Lars, too, is there's a bigger societal issue here.
Yeah.
The nonprofits in our local areas depend upon these small businesses for resources. By shutting down the small businesses, we're cutting off resources to all these local nonprofits that serve people in need.
Absolutely right. That's Jim Bernot from Willamette Valley Vineyards. Back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. If you don't like Twitter, go to our website. It's nice and clean. No Twitter, no Jack Dorsey there. You know, one of my favorite writers out there, and I'm not saying this just to butter him up, but the fact is there are some great writers out there, and then there are pedestrian writers. And I consider Kevin Williamson to be one of the great writers out there, roving correspondent for National Review, and the author of a brand new book that's out tomorrow called Big White Ghetto, Dead Broke, Stone Cold Stupid, and High on Rage in the Dank Woolly Wilds of the Real America. Kevin, it almost sounds like a title that they'd have to make the book physically larger to hold that entire title, but welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's always nice to be back. You know, this is the first radio show I ever did, so it's always fun to be on your show.
Really? This was the first show you ever did? Because you're everywhere
these days. Outside of local stuff in Philadelphia, yeah.
Okay. Well, Philly, that's an interesting town these days. We could get into a conversation about that. By the way, I'm an admirer of the current police chief there. She was here, and she is one of those people who, like Trump, like you suggested, Trump, that they do not, meaning Trumpers or Trumpists like me, they do not embrace him in spite of the schoolyard insults, Twitter tantrums, and conspiracy nonsense, but because of those things, which represent weapons in a fight to liberate public life from the straitjacket of respectability. I think Danielle Outlaw in your town has actually, she's a black female and probably slightly politically liberal, but boy, she doesn't hold back when it comes to saying things the way they are. And Kevin, your book speaks directly to me because over the years, I've become so frustrated with politicians. You'll ask them a question and like your grandma might have said, they couldn't say butter if they had a mouthful of it.
Yeah, I think that you see politicians on both sides right now who are just really terrified of their constituencies. And, you know, in general, I kind of like politicians to be a little terrified of their constituents because I think that's a healthy kind of democratic attitude. But at some point, there's a difference between trying to govern people based on their opinions and govern people based on their interests. And people's opinions in the short term bounce all over the place, all over the map. Their interests more or less stay the same for long periods of time. And I think real political leadership consists of being able to accommodate one while working on the other and understanding the importance of both of those things and doing the right thing even when it runs against people's opinions. And we don't really have a lot of that just right now. And I certainly saw that when I was in Portland writing about the troubles up there.
Well, I mean, the troubles, they were the worst two blocks from my main studios at our flagship station. But I just, for the life of me, can't understand why when you're facing desperate situations like that, your city is on fire. People are being killed in some cases. Stores are being looted. Why you can't get politicians who come out and actually thunder from the bully pulpit. Instead, you get this, well, I want to be really careful not to affect anybody's free speech rights. Well, that doesn't include burning things down and hurting people. And yet we've got, for the most part, other than Trump, we have a lot of politicians who don't want to say what the problem really is or speak to it. They want to be diplomatic about it. We didn't hire them to be diplomats. We hired them to represent us.
Well, I think we want them to be diplomatic about things, but we also want them to tell the truth and do the right thing. And that's part of representing us as well. I think that, you know, particularly with the George Floyd riots, it's an interesting thing from my point of view because we're always told that the United States is this, you know, systemically racist society, and we're just a fundamentally racist culture and fundamentally racist people. But the worst thing you can be in American society is racist. No one in politics, no one in public life can really own up to being a racist in public. And it's kind of an interesting paradox. And I think that the fear of being called a racist promiscuously and irresponsibly is something that keeps a lot of politicians from exercising real leadership in the face of some of these things. And, of course, the irony of that is that the people who suffer the most from it tend to be non-white people in poor neighborhoods.
Well, tell me this, Kevin, though, when you say, and it is, it's the scarlet letter these days that if somebody reliably calls you out as a racist, your career may be over. If you're in politics, your political career may be over. And yet, do the rules apply equally to everybody? Because I saw Joe Biden tell a man in my business that if he wasn't voting for Biden, he wasn't black. And I've seen him say other similar crazy stuff. And you'd say, boy, if that was a Republican had said something like that, they'd be in big trouble.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the double standard of these sorts of things. Now, again, I don't think that Joe Biden's a racist. I think he's someone who's kind of a doofus and often doesn't express himself very well. But, you know, we do have genuine racists in public life on the left, you're right, who don't get called out for it, who do, and who manage to endure in polite society. I don't know how many times I've been on television with Al Sharpton, but, you know, he's a pretty good example of that. And, you know, you sit there and you smile and you act like everything's normal, and you do what you do. Yeah, there's obviously a double standard there, but, man, if we start getting on to the subject of conservatives and liberals and double standards, we'll never talk about anything else.
No, we won't.
We could do an hour of it.
Kevin, it's a pleasure, as always, to have you on the program. Thanks so much for coming on, and congratulations on Big White Ghetto. And we'll leave the rest of the inside baseball joke to others. But check it out. The author is Kevin Williamson, and his writing is absolutely extraordinary, by my measure, anyway. Kevin, thanks so very much. Glad to have you with me, and if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go right to me, nobody else, talk@LarsLarson.com. I'm also on Parler at Lars Radio, and if you want to tell your Alexa device to play the Lars Larson Show, glad to have you do that as well. And vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get back to your phone calls and emails just a bit later on in the show at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, our website's always available. Also, don't forget to vote in our Twitter poll. We put up a brand new question written out of the news of the day every single day. Now, when I started doing talk radio a long time ago, in fact, about the time that my next guest was born, I learned very quickly that abortion was pretty much a dead-end topic because people have fixed positions on it for the most part. In America, there are some people who believe that they have a right to kill unborn babies. And then there are those of us who are pro-life who believe that killing unborn babies is an evil thing to do. And it's a pretty big gulf, and America is pretty polarized over the entire issue, going all the way back to the 1973 decision, Roe versus Wade, in which the Supreme Court issued a finding that a woman had a right to obtain an abortion from a doctor and that the Constitution protected her right to medical privacy. In any case, we are now in a different era. A lot of years have gone by. Around 50 million unborn babies have been killed, and that's a fact the left does not like to be reminded of. Well, there's a brand new book out by Danielle D'Souza. She happens to be the daughter of a very good friend of the program, and that's Dinesh D'Souza, the great filmmaker and author. And it's my pleasure to welcome Danielle to the program. Ms. D'Souza, congratulations on this new book, The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on your show.
What was it like growing up with a dad who's constantly churning out great best-selling books and now making movies as well? Did you feel compelled, I have to sit down and write a book of some consequence?
No, not at all. I think I was always just, you know, so enthralled with, especially the debates he would do. He would do these really cool debates with Christopher Hitchens on, you know, God and atheism, and kind of seeing him just in the middle of all the craziness of politics made me very intrigued.
And it sounds like you learned the Socratic method from your dad, that you can get some really good answers if you just ask really good and pointed questions.
Yes, yes. Whenever he'd finish a speech or something, I would have like 20 questions to ask after. So, and I've always lived in a liberal area, you know, California. I went to school at Dartmouth, and now I live in New York City. So I'm always around people on the left. So it's really good to, I think, just be equipped and kind of have the knowledge to be able to talk about, you know, what you believe in.
So tell me what you sought to do in writing The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America, and how you could perhaps take what you point out in the book is kind of a stale situation where the sides have been chosen, people have taken up their sides based on their point of view. Occasionally, we hear about people who go from being pro-abortion to being pro-life, but we don't hear it all that often. Many people are very fixed in their positions. What did you think you would bring that was new to this debate?
Well, I think so often we don't actually see a discussion of the ideas. It kind of just remains surface level, and there's no debate that happens between the two sides. So often the pro-abortion side doesn't want to engage with pro-lifers because they know that when their arguments are put up against ours, they just look horrible, and it's just very, very sad for, someone who's an objective viewer watching something like that. So I felt like in my book it would be really important to have, I have about 22 of the most popular pro-choice arguments that then I debunk and I respond to, but I don't just go into the ones like a fetus is a cluster of cells or my body, my choice. I also look at things like, what about the welfare state? How would we pay for these kids? Or what if they're unwanted children? What if they end up being abused in their home and they're suffering and they're better off dead? What about, the fact that there are so many people in this world who go through horrible things? Maybe this fetus is just another victim. And, some people just have horrible lives. So I kind of try to go into more of the spicy topics as well as what I think that my friends and people I talk to actually ask about this issue, as opposed to just what are kind of the main talking points.
I'm talking to Danielle D'Souza, the daughter of Dinesh D'Souza. Her book is called The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. So how do you take those on? And is it a little bit crazy that we live in a country where somebody might advance the argument why we're saving money on welfare and food stamps because we're killing children so they won't grow up and have to be fed? It's a little bit of it's an unbelievable argument to me that somehow America would rather kill these children than feed them and educate them.
Yeah, and I think what's shocking to me is the fact that the same people who make that argument want to give free health care to illegal immigrants. They basically want us to live in a nation with open borders and let anybody come here where taxpayers here will pay for everything. And so this idea that, oh, no, wait, but if it's for, an unborn child or someone in a difficult situation like that who is an American, who's born on American soil, they say, no, never mind, we actually don't have the money. So I think that's pretty shocking, but also just the fact that people on the left present abortion as a positive good. They present it as something that's empowering for women. They try to always make it into a message of something to push. Whenever Governor Cuomo lit up the Freedom Tower pink in New York to celebrate 9-month abortions for no medical reason.
Ms. D'Souza, do you get the sense from both Governor Northam's comments about post-birth abortion, if you will, and the lack of reaction from the left as an indication that perhaps the pro-abortion side of this argument wants to take this even further than it already is, not just abortion up to the moment of birth, but perhaps even the death of the baby caused by a doctor after the birth of the baby? That's where they want to go?
Absolutely. We have already reached that point. I mean, President Trump announced that he was signing the Born Alive Protection Act. And I think that the fact that there's quibbling even about that with Democrats, and that is, by the way, when a child, they tried to abort it, but it lived through the procedure, it's born outside the womb. Democrats think that that child should die. And so the fact that we have to fight to protect that child shows that this isn't about location. This isn't about the fact that, oh, look, it's just exited the womb, because we all know that, A, birth is actually not just, a one-second process. It's a long process. And so there isn't just a poof moment where all of a sudden now this is a person. And before that, it was nothing. It was a cluster of cells. It was an appendix. It was a polyp, which is what they argue. So we're really fighting to protect babies from being dismembered by these people who call themselves doctors but are actually abortionists.
Ms. D'Souza, there are an awful lot of places on planet Earth where life is not held as sacred the way it is in the United States. But what does it say about our society that we've been willing to tolerate this debate for the better part of 50 years and tolerate 50 million deaths of unborn children? And now we're talking doctor-assisted suicide. The Netherlands has already said they're open to euthanasia for children under the age of 12. I mean, is America starting to embrace a culture of death?
Yeah, we actually have some of the most radical abortion policies in the entire world. So if we came out and said, we're not going to allow third trimester abortions anymore for no medical reason, those women wouldn't be able to go to Europe and get one, because a lot of countries don't allow that.
I'm talking to Danielle D'Souza Gill, who is the author most recently of The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. And yes, if you recognize the name, her father is Dinesh D'Souza, but this is her book and her work. She learned well, apparently, apparently from her father. He's written best-selling books about politics and about important issues in America. He's also made some great films, and it seems his daughter is doing the same. We'll be back in just a moment, and I'll get to your phone calls and emails a bit later. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a real pleasure for me to have Danielle D'Souza with me, the daughter of a good friend of mine, Dinesh D'Souza, who's written so many great books, but now she's written a great book of her own. It's called The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. And you write that for 50 years, the abortion debate has remained stagnant, trapped in sterile categories and familiar rhetoric. I want you to speak to that for just a moment, if you will, because there is a sense with this issue in particular, unlike issues on firearms or issues on energy or issues on any other kind of policy you'd care to name, where both sides believe, perhaps accurately, that if they are to cave in on any small point, that they assume that that is going to be a cave in that will lead to further losses. And that applies to both sides to some extent, that if somebody who's pro-life like me says, if we give in a little bit and acknowledge that some abortions are okay, as Ronald Reagan, your dad's former boss, felt that abortions in the case of rape and incest might be appropriate and perhaps should be legal, but not abortion for convenience. The pro-life side says, no, we're not giving an inch. But then the pro-abortion side does the same thing. They say, we're not willing to limit the third trimester abortions you mentioned in the last segment. We're not willing to give up on partial birth abortion. We're not willing to give up on anything. And both sides stay locked into those absolute positions. Can you speak to that for a moment?
Yeah, I actually think that's a big mistake, because I think that, you know, it's very similar to the issue of slavery. They didn't in one day abolish slavery. It took a process. It took time. And they had to start first with the limiting of slavery. So saying, okay, we can't let this continue to extend. And they had certain states vote on it, you know, up or down. Some states had slaves, some states didn't. And then they had to move to, you know, abolishing it. But I think that when it comes to abortion, that is exactly what we need to do. We need to limit abortion. We need to stop it, you know, from spreading in this case to late term. And then from there, what we really need to do is, as far as our Supreme Court, is overturn Roe v. Wade, because what Roe v. Wade did was take away the state's right to vote on this issue. They basically said, you know, if you're a state that wants to have limits on abortion, let's say you want to pass a heartbeat bill, you really can't. You can't. It doesn't matter if you all believe that. It doesn't matter if you think the unborn is worthy of protecting. We don't care, because this is unconstitutional. So if Roe v. Wade is knocked down, it's not like women won't have access to abortion. If you're living in a place like New York or California, they will likely pass a similar law where you would be able to do the same thing, but states would then be able to vote to restrict it if they wanted to. So I think that's really the first step. And then from there, we could move to something like an amendment and so on. But this idea that it's going to happen, you know, in one second is, I think, a mistake. And we're not going to have actually any progress or any change unless we focus on kind of doing it in an incremental fashion.
Ms. D'Souza's book is called The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. Danielle D'Souza Gill is its author. Let me ask you about that. Can you foresee the day, especially with a new composition to the U.S. Supreme Court, could you foresee the day where Americans look back on Roe v. Wade the same way we look back on Dred Scott and some of the other famous mistakes, about a dozen of them at least, that the United States Supreme Court has made over the years? Because I get a little tired of hearing the pro-abortion side saying, well, it's the law of the land, to which I'm kind of inclined to shout occasionally, Ms. D'Souza, and say, well, Dred Scott was the law of the land too. Do you want to get behind that? Or Korematsu, or some of the other crazy decisions that occasionally the Supreme Court has gotten it completely wrong. Could you foresee the day where we actually overturn Roe v. Wade and return this to the states?
Absolutely. I think that Roe v. Wade will go on the ash heap of history, just as Plessy versus Ferguson did. Brown v. Board of Education came around and said, separate is not equal. Simple. So I think that in order for a lethal blow to be thrown at Roe v. Wade, they would have to come around and say something like, abortion is not in the Constitution. There is no right to privacy when it comes to applying that to abortion. And so it's not a constitutional right. So absolutely. And I think even when we think of slavery, when we look back, you know, we always ask, how could people have done this? How could people, you know, have not done more? And actually, there were very few abolitionists. They were a very small sector. Many of them were strong Christians, but there were a lot of Christians who did not get involved, and they they weren't fighting on the abolitionist side. So I think that that'll be the same when it comes to the pro-life movement. I think after, you know, Roe v. Wade is overturned, well, people will look back and say, wow, how did these so many people advocate for abortion on demand, abortion at 9 months? And they're going to want to take moral credit for basically the pro-life side fighting for the unborn lives. And when we look at it now, we'll say, well, where were you now? Where were you when we needed you and we were actually in the middle of this fight? But of course, you know, everybody later will want to take moral credit for it.
I want to ask you about something. I've not received my copy of The Choice yet, so perhaps you spoke to this in the book, but one of the things that's always confounded me, I've been a journalist for about 45 years. I have never seen anyone but my show do a discussion of the idea that almost all Down syndrome babies do not survive to birth because they are terminated during the pregnancy. And nobody talks about this. I've never heard somebody say, well, I was talking to my daughter or my son-in-law and they've decided to, you know, get rid of the baby because it's a Down syndrome baby, according to the amniocentesis. I don't hear people even talk about it. But I know it's happening because the doctors say perhaps as many as 90% of all Down syndrome children are aborted during pregnancy. And that seems like one of the things that would be an easy one to convince the public of. Should we exterminate a baby simply because it's not perfect? And yet I don't hear that discussed at all. And I wish the pro-life side would bring it up as well and say, this is an easy one. Can we just agree not to kill babies simply because they're not exactly perfect?
Yeah, well, actually, that is one of the pro-choice sides they claim is their strongest argument. They say, oh my gosh, you know, how can you force someone to have a child with Down syndrome? How can you force someone to have a child with, you know, a learning disability? They basically advocate, and this is already happening in Europe, for 100% abortion rate when it comes to aborting any child that has, you know, any kind of difference. And we even see this now with sex selection as well. Many people wait until they can find out the gender of their baby, baby boy or baby girl. And if they say, oh, you know, that's not the gender I wanted, they say abort. And of course, we see that at that point, the child already has genitalia. The child already has sex hormones. It is literally, you know, you could have a gender reveal party and they are being aborted based on their sex. Clarence Thomas has even written about this as far as race. There's clear race discrimination here. More black babies are aborted than white babies. So we see that at the center of abortion is not this whole, you know, right to privacy, women's rights movement, all of this. It's really about racism and it's about sexism and choosing who has value as a person.
Well, and in fact, as technology gets better, you could imagine this getting even worse. It's not just gender selection or finding out if the baby has Down syndrome, but you could literally say, we wanted a tall child. We wanted a child who has an IQ above 110. And who knows, we may have the ability to determine those things in utero, and people will begin to make even more exacting choices as though they're shopping for some consumer retail item.
Exactly. And this whole idea of treating humans this way, I mean, this is eugenics. This is Margaret Sanger. This is the ideology that she founded Planned Parenthood based on. And this is even very, you know, reminiscent of the Holocaust in the sense that people basically dehumanized other humans.
We're going to come back in just a moment. One more segment with Ms. Gill, if she can spare the time for us. And then I'll get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can answer my Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. And our Facebook page is The Lars Larson Show. And, of course, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you, and always a pleasure to speak to Danielle D'Souza Gill, who is the author of a brand-new book called The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. I want to ask you straight out, how do you think the new composition of the United States Supreme Court is going to affect this discussion, especially as a woman is being included in the court who is the mother of seven and the mother of a special needs child and the mother of adopted children as well? I understand that Amy Coney Barrett, who I have great respect for, Judge Barrett, has said, I will decide things based on the law and the Constitution. I know that. She's also the first Supreme Court justice to sit on the court while having school-age children. And does this change the entire perspective of how the Supreme Court might rule on future cases involving abortion, given that we have, you know, we've changed the membership quite dramatically in the first term of the Trump administration?
Yeah, I think that, you know, even what fueled kind of the apoplexy over Trump was the fact that they feared he'd remake our courts. And he has. He's had huge influence on our courts. And when we look at even now with Amy Coney Barrett, we see this, you know, intense pushback against her. They're really searching for something to get her on, and it's very clear that it's not working. So I think Amy Coney Barrett will be confirmed, but the left knows that it's all about Roe v. Wade. They know that Roe v. Wade is at risk. We don't actually need Chief Justice Roberts in order to overturn it. He's voted in favor of pro-choice decisions in the past. But it was a 7-2 majority that got us Roe v. Wade. So I imagine it will take a 7-2 majority for us to overturn it. And I think that it's not just going to be in our lifetime, but soon, that we could see Roe v. Wade overturned, because this has really been brewing in America for a long time. And I think it's finally bubbling to the surface.
But Danielle, does this mean that the pro-abortion side of the argument, they prefer to call themselves pro-choice, but their aversion to the word itself speaks loudly to me? If you can't even say the word when you're discussing it, you choose to use euphemisms like choice, that seems to be an admission that you yourself find the subject uncomfortable, even though they like to herald it in the ways that you've mentioned in your book, the choice. But are they effectively admitting that they know that abortion is not constitutional, and that they merely want to hang on to that status as long as they possibly can, because they understand that when real textualists, real originalists will look at the Constitution on this new court, that they will find, no, it wasn't constitutional. There was no right to privacy, and there's certainly no right to obtain an abortion.
Yeah, I mean, they can't defend it. There's no way they can defend it. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg has written about the fact that the justification for Roe v. Wade was completely off. She's written that she would have preferred to see it kind of cast in a different light to justify abortion, find different reasons to justify it. But even she has said that this idea that it's based on privacy does not make any sense. And you'll never find a leftist today really diving into what is the the constitutional reasoning behind this, because there really wasn't any. And we even saw Amy Coney Barrett say that Roe v. Wade is not super precedent. And that's because the American people have not accepted it. So, no, I don't think that the left is going to be able to constitutionally justify Roe v. Wade. Maybe they will emotionally, but definitely not based on the Constitution.
I'm talking to Danielle D'Souza Gill. Her book is called The Choice, the Abortion Biden America. Ms. Gill, I'll use all of your names, because that way I'll cover all the bases and I won't get in trouble with anyone. Danielle, tell me this. One of the most troubling aspects of abortion for me, sort of from a 30,000 foot level, is that when you look down, you see the pro-abortion side saying, why, here's this woman who's the victim of incest. You want to make her carry the child. And then you have a woman who's been the victim of a rape, you know, who survived a rape, and she has a child, and it's problematic. And they make those arguments. But for the most part, isn't it the case that most abortions in America are a matter of convenience? And by that I mean, a young woman becomes pregnant, and she says, this doesn't work for me because I'm not economically equipped to deal with it. Or a young woman is on her way to college and she says, this is going to interrupt my college or my professional career. Or she's left one relationship and is in another relationship and says, since this baby occurred as a result of my last relationship, the baby is a problem in my new relationship. And that those million abortions a year or so that we hear about, for the most part, are not cases of rape or assault or incest or cases like that. They are, for the most part, a matter of, this isn't convenient for me. And for me, personally, as a pro-choice person, that's the most troubling one. When somebody just says, I'll have a baby in a couple of years, but it's not convenient at this time. Again, going back to my comparison, it's not the right time for me to buy a new car or to buy a house or to move to a new job, so I'm just not going to do it. Except a baby is none of those things. A baby is life, and yet they throw it away for convenience. Isn't that the root cause of most abortions in America today?
Yeah, that's what the statistics show us. About less than 0.01% of abortion is due to incest. Less than 0.5% is due to rape. So whenever these statistics are flung in our way, we could say, okay, well, fair enough, but what about the rest of them? What about the other 0.9% of abortions going on in America? Unfortunately, abortion is being used as a form of birth control. Most women who get an abortion are likely to do it more than once. So it's the left throws out the statistics that one in four women get an abortion, but the reality is it's actually the same woman getting it again and again. So this is what we're up against. And I think it really comes down to the messaging of the left, which is that if you get an abortion, then you're an empowered woman. And if you don't get an abortion, your life is ruined. Your life's going to be horrible. Now, they never want to talk about adoption, which is the actual alternative. Let's assume you're not going to raise this child no matter what. That's off the table. You have goals in life. You don't want to do it. Okay. Well, what about adoption? There are about 35 families waiting for every child available for adoption. So an adoption usually takes about a year. It's a huge, long process. It's very expensive as well. And these parents, I mean, when they adopt that child, they don't see it in the light that you saw it. Maybe it was a horrible, you know, thing for you, but to them, I mean, they're going to love this child and raise it their entire lives, and you won't have to deal with it again. There are closed adoptions, completely anonymous. There's no connection anymore. So I think that we really need to push the message of adoption instead of abortion, because it's really a beautiful solution to a difficult situation.
And yet, as we head up to the holiday season this fall, we're likely to see the Planned Parenthood folks, the largest abortion provider in America, send out offers to sell you a box of Choice on Earth cards. Does it stun you that this group actually sees taking the words associated with the most famous birth in world history, the birth of Jesus Christ, and then saying instead of peace on earth, it's choice on earth, mixing together Christmas, the birth of Jesus Christ, and abortion, the death of a million babies?
Yeah, and of course we even see with, you know, Mary and the birth of Jesus that in many ways was the first unplanned pregnancy, not in the eyes of God, but, you know, in the eyes of Mary and Joseph and the other people involved. You know, Jesus kind of was a big surprise. And so I think it's actually really beautiful to see that kind of what has saved our entire world kind of came from that. And also just the fact that Mary is so uplifted by Christianity shows really how the pro-life movement also views the woman. You know, we don't just love the baby, we love the mother as well, and both parties. So, no, I think Christmas is a really beautiful reminder of that. But the fact that the left uses God, they use words like faith in order to twist their ideology into something that's good, I think that's probably the most evil. And there are even organizations out there like Shout Your Abortion, God Loves Abortion. They post photos of little, you know, babies with halos and saying they're for abortion, and all this very twisted, disgusting imagery in order to push abortion as if that's what God would want. I think that's our biggest obstacle.
Her brand new book is The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. She is Danielle D'Souza Gill. Ms. Gill, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so very much, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Back in just a moment to your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and naysayers go to the head of the line. You know, the fate of Obamacare is a bit up in the air, although when the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments today, it seemed that some of the justices are telegraphing that they might be willing to not find it unconstitutional, even though I really think it is. But is Obamacare the right solution for America's health care problems? I think there's a better way. And to suggest the practical way to get to that, Dr. Darcy Bryan joins me with the Mercatus Center. Dr. Bryan is an obstetrician gynecologist with an active practice at Women's Care Florida in Tampa. Dr. Bryan, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thank you, Lars, and I'm pleased to be with you.
There are a lot of people out there who, thank you for that. There are a lot of people out there who apparently believe that money can solve almost any problem. And in fact, we see evidence of that in the federal government all the time. Oh, there's a problem? Let's pass a bill and shovel dollars at it. But the Affordable Care Act made that promise, saying, oh, if we just make sure that everybody has insurance one way or the other, whether the taxpayers pay for it or we subsidize it or we force people to buy the kind of health care that we want them to buy, that's going to solve the problems in health care. It's not very sensible thinking, is it?
Well, I think that's a very unsensible thinking, and unfortunately, it's very tempting to think that way because, you know, as a first world nation, we tend to think of the more money we spend, the better outcomes we have. But unfortunately, spending more money doesn't translate to better outcomes. And our healthcare system is a perfect example of that. We spend incredible amounts of money with no true significant improvement in population health. And unfortunately, the big temptation is to think, well, if we give people access to this healthcare system through insurance, then that's going to translate to better health for the people of America. And unfortunately, and I wish it were true, by the way, it doesn't translate. Health insurance does not translate into health. There's so many other components to health. And as much as I love what I do, as much as I'm proud to be a physician, healthcare is just one component to health. And, you know, living in a safe neighborhood, having a great job, you know, having people who love you, that's all health, you know. And so when we spend so much money pouring it into one small fragment of what it means to be a healthy person, which is access to a doctor, then we're doing ourselves as a nation a big disservice.
So what do you think is the right direction to go, Doctor? There's so many questions I'm tempted to ask you, but tell me this. What's your prescription?
Well, what I would really love to see is us not to be seduced by this line and distracted by this focus on insurance, because in essence, we've got a very, very dysfunctional system. Our priorities are pretty much messed up in healthcare, unfortunately, and it really has to do with our payment models. And so there's all these perverse incentives for volume, for ordering tests, for interventions that don't necessarily translate to quality. So what I would love to see is for us to change our emphasis for paying for stuff to actually to focusing on quality and outcomes. Are we actually meeting our stated goals as providers? Are we making the sick well? And that I would love for us to be our revealed and true mission statement. And I think in order to make that happen, what we get distracted by is tweaking insurance models and payment models and telling providers and hospitals what will or will not be paid for, which I understand because we've got exploding costs. But it prevents quality because it prevents innovation. And so, for example, you can do a lot to try to improve quality in healthcare through things like telemedicine, autonomous models like artificial intelligence. But we have really no way to reward innovation in our current system.
Well, and the other component to it that I didn't hear you mention, but I'm curious about it. You're an obstetrician and a gynecologist.
Yes.
So don't we have a tremendous problem with babies who die or with pregnancy? And yet an awful lot of that, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm looking at it from the male point of view, but isn't one of the biggest problems getting women who are pregnant to go and see a doctor? For instance, if you had a young lady who's just found out she's pregnant, how many times should she see a doctor in a routine, no problems pregnancy between now and the day she gives birth? 8 or 10 times?
Lars, I would even counteract that we make it very hard for a healthy working woman who's pregnant to maintain her job because we set the parameters of how she gets cared for by a brick-and-mortar building where we have a lot of studies, you know, Mayo Clinic has done good work on this as well, showing that telemedical interventions do just as well, you know, in a low-risk setting. So what I'm trying to circle back to is you're absolutely right. I think what you're saying is that we assume and we're making people pay for something that they may not necessarily value, which goes back to, you know, the mandate, the individual mandate of ACA. You've got to buy health insurance. Well, there's a fair amount of the population who doesn't value seeing a physician, who doesn't even if you handed them access on a silver platter, would not walk in.
Dr. Darcy Bryan, who is at the Mercatus Center, and she has a practice in women's health care in Florida, Tampa, Florida. Always glad to get your emails. Talk at LarsLarson.com and tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show.